The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody wants everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Well, hello, and thanks for joining us again on the Mike Lupica Podcast, which grows in popularity every single week. Today, we'll be talking with Paul Anacone, who coached Pete Sampras and Roger Federer, in the same career. But before we get started, this from ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anybody else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within, wait for it, 1 day. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. Welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast, which is being taped today on the third day of the United States Open Tennis. And because it's the Open, because it's tennis, I went looking for one of the smartest tennis guys I know. He is, when you look at the big picture, as prominent a tennis coach as men's tennis has ever seen, because in the same career, Paul Anacone coached Pete Sampras and, by the way, Roger Federer. We know each other for 1,000 years from the Hamptons. He's a local. I imagine myself as one. I watched his boy Nick grow up into a basketball player. Our boys went to the same sports camp in summer. And we'll get to this later, but I also sat in Louis Armstrong Stadium, watched him beat John McEnroe one time in the first round of the U.S. Open. He has a new book out called Coaching for Life. He joins us today. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Mike. Thanks a lot for the invite. Great to chat with you.
Paul, so the other day, I'm playing in my dopey annual Artist Writers Charity softball game in East Hampton, and I look over, and who's there but Anacone?
That's right.
And so a few months ago, our mutual pal Mary Carrillo knows that if I'm not writing and I'm around, I the Tennis Channel is on with me. And I will watch, Paul, Mary knows this, I will watch anything, okay? And and Paul, she knows I think of this as interactive because I'm constantly texting her while you guys are on the air. Okay.
I love it. Wait a second. I got to interrupt 1 second. I know it's interactive because I saw you do the impossible. There was one day when we were commentating and one of the coaches got into that Indian sitting position and then jumped up on TV. And then I think Justin tried to do it. He couldn't do it. I thought he was going to have to go to the hospital. I didn't even dare try. And then I saw a little snippet that you actually completed the exercise, which was very impressive.
So that's what I was getting to. So they're on television, okay? They're on television and they're going, wow, that's pretty impressive. And I'm sitting here in my writing cottage in Connecticut and I'm thinking, I can do that. So I'm not great at taking selfies, okay? But I managed to get the phone and I take a video of myself just effortlessly standing up out of this Indian sitting position and I send it to Carrillo. And before long, she says, wow, Paul and everybody else is really impressed. I said, no, that wasn't for everybody to see. That was just for you to see.
You can't do that to Mary. You know it's public domain once that happens.
So Anacone is nice enough to come watch our dopey softball game the other day. And I said, just so you don't think It was trick photography within 30 seconds of us saying hello. What did I do?
You did it. And I my jaw dropped. I still can't believe you can do it. You're a much more nimble man than I, and I'm very impressed to this day.
All right, Paul, we're having this conversation about, 12 or 13 hours after it's such a compelling match last night between Fed and Francis Tiafoe and, before we talk about Tiafoe, because I want him to be great, and I hope he's going to be great, what did you see from Fed, and did you see enough from him to make you believe he's healthy enough to win the U.S. Open?
Yeah, I did, Mike. And one of the things that I think that the all-time greats do better than we mere mortals even understand is detach from what's happened, and they don't allow what has just happened affect what can happen right now, the next thing. And Roger played average last night for Roger, but I guarantee you he gave it about 30 seconds thought. He and Severin Luti and Ivan Ljubicic probably went through it a little bit today, and that's a little bit of rust as part of the byproduct of him dealing with a bad back for the last couple weeks. Probably didn't get as much tennis in as he would like. And oh, by the way, Francis Tiafoe was very, very good last night.
Yeah,
so it was.
Yeah.
It could have been a perfect storm for a disaster for Roger Federer. But if I'm Francis Tiafoe, I'm thinking, okay, I'm getting close. And if I'm Roger Federer, I'm thinking, no problem, I got through it. I live to play another day, and I can promise you, I will keep getting better in this tournament.
And by the way, when we talk about my friend Paul Anacone coaching Sampras and Federer, he didn't coach them for all their majors, but you know what? You still say he coached two guys who combined have won 33 major singles championships. And Paul, the thing that we're all struck by now, and you saw with a ringside seat, is what a joyful warrior this guy have in your career. Have you ever seen anybody who not just, you see a lot of people who love tennis, but Paul, it's more than that. He loves being Roger Federer.
Yeah, I've been around a lot of athletes in my life. I've never seen an athlete at this level or even close that really fully embraces his environment, who he is, the responsibilities of it, and doesn't get the emotional fuel tank drained from it. I mean, it is absolutely incredible. He's very at peace with who he is. He loves his family. He loves being a citizen of the world. And the bottom line, too, is that he still loves this game. And I've had this conversation with Pete Sampras often about it, because when I first started working with Roger, Pete kept saying to me, how does he play this much still? I mean, why does he care if he wins another Basel or Vienna, or well, how is he doing this? And I said, you know, he loves the game. He loves tennis, loves to have his family with him on the road, enjoys the different cities. He is truly a citizen of the world. And Mike, I think for his longevity now at 36 years of age, that's the only way to give yourself a chance to sustain the level of excellence we've seen from him, is to have a happiness, is to have a peace of mind and contentment. And he realizes that, look, if I win a few more, that's great. But if I don't, that's fine. I've had a great career. I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and I'll just keep it going at it. So I think his perspective really, really enables that awesome talent to still kind of flow to the top.
You know, it's funny because the Lupica boys grew up and began to love tennis watching Pete. And my oldest, Christopher, you would never remember this. One of the greatest moments, and Chris has had, and all of my sons have had, as I'm sure Nick Anacone has had, a chance to have a backstage pass, okay? Your backstage pass in tennis has been a lot better than mine. But there was a day at the old stadium at the Open, okay, and Christopher was there with me, and you and Pete and I and Christopher just chatted for about 20 minutes, and he's never forgot it. The greatest day he ever had watching tennis in person was Pete's last championship over Andre. But this is a long way around of asking you, did you always think Fed was built to last? Because we know how fragile Pete was, and now here's a guy, Federer, who really didn't get hurt until he's 34, going on 35 last year.
Right. Yeah, you know, the thing that always amazed me. When I first started working with Roger, his strength and conditioning coach, a guy named Pierre Paganini, who's been with Roger now, I actually think right around 20, 21 years. I think he started with Roger when he was 14 or 15. This guy is the absolute best in the business, Mike. I mean, he knows Roger's body and his mind and his life inside and out. He also trained Stan Wawrinka, who's a very different athlete. And Pierre totally amazed me with his abilities to mix and match skill sets and train guys to maximize their talent level. And Stan, poor Stan, just had, you know, his knee surgery a couple weeks ago. But he's been pretty much of a warrior as well with his body, and a very different body than Roger. So that being said, I think Roger's taken great care in managing his body, number one. Number two, when you do that and you have his disposition where you can continue to play and deal with adversity and not let it knock you off the rails, I mean, that to me is a recipe for success, and it's a recipe for longevity. And Mike, you know as well or better than I is that these guys, the hardest thing is generally they only make news when they lose. They're supposed to win now.
Right.
And so,
right.
And that was part of the recipe, one of the ingredients with Pete that actually made it very difficult. For the last 25 months, when he didn't win a tournament before the U.S. Open, every news conference and every day was, what's wrong? You're a step slower. You got married.
Right.
Why are you still playing? And no matter how positive you are, when you get that much negativity thrown at you or that much doubt, it becomes very difficult, and that really drained Roger. That really drained Pete. Whereas Roger doesn't waste. I've never seen a human being that wastes less energy on stuff that he can't control. And that doesn't mean he's flippant. That doesn't mean he doesn't care what people think. He does, but he also has such great perspective, and really his pragmatism is a thing of beauty to watch. And I can tell you, coaching that just allows so many great things to happen, because you know he's going to handle adversity just like it's not a big deal. And Mike, you know this too, is that look, there's a handful of great days during your year as an athlete. There's a handful of terrible days. And those days in the middle, that's what make you up. And Rogers, those days in the middle, not a big deal. He gets through them, no wasted emotion, on to the next day.
We're talking to Paul Anacone, who, and to put this in perspective with other sports, coaching Sampras and Federer in the same career is like if you had gotten to be Bill Belichick, but also coached Peyton before you coached Tom Brady. All right, Paul, in coaching for life, it's about more than tennis. But what I want to ask you is, wasn't it pretty daunting to coach two guys this good?
It was really interesting, Mike, and I had a great mentor in a number of people. I started at Bolitari's Academy when I was a kid, so Nick coached me for many, many years. Then my coach in college, Mike DePalmer Sr., was a tremendous coach at the university, and also coached me, his son, Ben Testerman, a couple other players. And then I had my brother who knew me better than anybody. So I've always felt like I was pretty much a student of the game, and I've tried to be a sponge. So when I started with Pete Sampras, it was a really tough scenario. As you may remember, Tim Gullickson had gotten diagnosed with brain tumors, right?
Yeah.
And so since I was just wrapping up my career, and the goal was for me to just kind of help out Pete for a while until Tim got well, because all of us are pretty, you know, our egos are pretty well checked at the door. We get along really well. So that mentorship from Tim, even in his illness, he was a maestro at educating me at how best to kind of manage the environment with Pete, understand what to emphasize, how to coach him. And, you know, look, it was daunting, it was exciting, but it was also kind of the catalyst for this brain, you know, child of mine to just kind of keep taking these notes. And at one point in time in my life, put this book together about, you know, why people that are excellent excel. Why do they do it? We see the forehands and backhands. We see Larry Bird and we see Michael Jordan and we see these guys hit these clutch jumpers. But how do they do it? There's so much more than the physical stuff that goes on. And what I found really interesting, Mike, was the differences between the great players like Sampras and Roger Federer and even Tim Henman, who I coached, who is top five in the world. They had very different personalities, but they had some very similar traits that allowed them to deal with adversity in a way that's very different, that the kind of run-of-the-mill pros don't do. And that's why they're able, in these big moments in Arthur Ashe Stadium, center court at Wimbledon, that's why they're able to trust themselves and come through. So it was daunting. It was exciting. I was unbelievably fortunate. And as Mary, our friend Mary Carrillo, continues to remind me, I've avoided real work for 54 years, so why stop now?
We're talking to Paul Anacone, whose new book is called Coaching for Life. We're going to get to Pete in greater detail, but because Fed played last night, because he's into the second round, I want to talk about this. Paul, did you have any idea when this kid with long hair from Switzerland beat Pete at Wimbledon 1,000 years ago that there was greatness in the house that day?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because I believe greatness is made up of three things: head, heart, and talent. For me as a tennis coach, I find it pretty easy to see who's extremely gifted talent-wise, physically, but the head and the heart are what drive that. So when I saw Roger beat Pete in 2001, I looked at a kid and saw immense talent, but I didn't know him at all. So I didn't know what his mind was like, and I didn't know what his ticker was like. And boy, oh boy, 16 years later, we've seen what both of those are like, and it has been just incredible to watch. So the physical talent was so apparent, and the way that he's molded it, I remember back around 2009, Mike, I was playing golf with Pete one day, and we were talking about his record, and we were talking about, finishing and having 14 majors, and he said, you know, it's so amazing to me to see how quickly Roger's right there and passed. And I didn't think that was going to happen. And Pete's he's pretty secure, too. And I said, well, what do you think? And he goes, you know what? I know how hard it was for me to do it, so to see him go flying by, that is just too good. Hats off. I mean, it's just amazing to see.
By the way, Anacone is a good golfer. He plays a lot of golf out in L.A. with my buddy Doc Rivers. And my favorite golf story of all time, and I don't think it's apocryphal because Larry Brown, who used to be in the Bel Air group, told me this story. And if I told you who said it, you'd know who it is from Bel Air. Okay. One day, Pete, by the way, who's great at golf, Pete is playing golf, and he's not playing well. And he's bitching and moaning. And finally, this guy says, oh, Pete, hold on a second. Hold on a second, okay? You've made more money in your career than you could ever possibly count or spend. You are married to a beautiful, you know what the story is. You know, you are married to a beautiful, wonderful actress, young woman. You have two gorgeous children. You're arguably the greatest tennis player of all time. So suck it up, okay? And Paul, Pete looked at the guy and he says, what do you mean arguably? That's all he heard. That's all he heard. Now, when you were talking about Federer's attitude, when I got to Wimbledon this year, I didn't realize how unusual it was what he was doing at his age in men's tennis. Okay. But through a little research, I found out that he had a chance to be and became the oldest man in 108 years to win the Wimbledon singles title. Okay. He was the oldest player since Arthur Ashe in 75, which I saw. And Arthur was only 31 when he did it. So what he's doing is completely off the rails for men's tennis. And there he is, and what he had to think might be his last great chance at the Australian Open. He's down 3-1 to his greatest adversary in the fifth set after this dream run for both of them. And afterwards, I was so fascinated. I know you were too, listening to him saying, no, I was good mentally at that point. I thought I was in good shape. I'd been playing well. I told myself it was one break. And I'm thinking, if it's me, I'm thinking, wait a minute. If I don't do this, I may never get this close ever again. And then he wins the last six games of the match.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. I got to catch up with Severin Luti and Roger and Ivan Ljubicic about an hour before the match, hour and a half before the match in the player lounge, and it was so interesting just to hear them talk. And the thing with Roger and Rafa is Roger has always felt like, you know, he can beat him, and he has beaten him. The style matchup, we all know, is very difficult with the lefty, huge lefty spinning forehand to the one-hander. Rafa's dominated on the slower surface. Roger's had a little more success but on the other surfaces, but Rafa's got the better of him. But what's interesting is there's also been a bunch of matches where Roger has basically hit Rafa off the court, most of them on faster courts.
Right.
I've seen a couple of them indoors. And the interesting thing in the 3 out of 5 set matches against Rafa is I had never seen Roger sustain the right mentality for entire 5 sets against Rafa.
Right,
Because what Rafa does to everybody, including Roger, including Novak, including Andy, is that he wears your will down because he has so much margin on his ground strokes. He hits his forehand with so much spin, and it's so heavy that when the nerves come, he's very unlikely to miss, and his wheels are incredible. And as you and I know, when nerves come in, a lot of things can happen. So usually what happens with Roger and Rafa is there's a tipping point moment in usually 3 out of 5 set matches where Roger will back up a little bit. He'll start to give Rafa a little bit more court position, and he'll get behind the baseline, and he'll be less offensive. Well, guess what? In Australia this year, down 3-1 in the fifth, he stayed with his game plan, and that last 20 minutes of offensive tennis, of clear, committed mindset from Federer, to me, was a thing of beauty just because it broke barriers in Roger's own mind. And I'd never seen him do that in 3 out of 5 sets. So for him to have that kind of commitment when we hadn't seen it that much in the past in a 3 out of 5 set match, that said something. But you're exactly right. He's, you know, if he loses that match, let's look at the major count there, right? The major count there it's right there. We're talking there. We're
17-15. It goes to 17-15. Rafa wins the French, Paul. It goes to 17-16.
Right.
And now it's game on. And now I don't believe Rafa can catch him. And I wrote this afterwards and I said it because what I watched from Roger that day made me think of Nicklaus. And on the day that he won his 18th major, Roger did, on the back nine at Augusta in 86. It was the most thrilling thing to see, okay? Mm-hmm. And what he did that day, and again, 18 was such a magic number. You're right. So much tennis history changed in what? In real time, what, Paul? About a half an hour?
25 minutes, probably?
Yeah.
3-1 in the fifth set? Yeah.
That's the beauty of sports. But tennis history, Federer's, Nadal's, the all-time records in tennis, you're right, a 25-minute span in Melbourne.
And it's amazing. And, you know, Mike, you know this so well, too. What I love about tennis, there's no place to hide. It's just you. I mean, as great as Tom Brady is, as great as Jordan is, LeBron, all these guys, you know, they're great, but they do have help. There's no place to – look, I've been on center court at Wimbledon and got my backside kick from Jimmy Connors, and John's beat me 1,000 times in big arenas, and it's just you. You're pretty naked. You better figure it out there. And I love that. And so when you see these individual athletes, whether it's Roger or Rafa or Serena or Martina Navratilova or John McEnroe, Sam, when you see them, it is so difficult to explain what it feels like when it's just up to you. When it's just up to you, that's it. And it's amazing to me when you see these athletes like the Federers and Nadals and Serenas that have been doing it for so long, and guess what? They're still doing it. It's amazing.
We'll have more with the great Paul Anacone after this from Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. Paul Anacone, his new book is called Coaching for Life. It is about Sampras and Federer and way more than that. Paul, as someone who is on the inside with him, I have a feeling that you might have told him over the years that he could maybe mess around with the backhand that changed everything this year. What made him finally come around?
Well, I think he, you know, we talked about it ad nauseum, and he did it, and he's always been able to do it on the faster courts, okay? The thing that we don't talk about a lot on TV, it's not like he's never done this before, and it's not like the conversation has never happened. It's just like when, you know, when he started when he started having a little bit more success a couple years ago, when Stefan was coaching, I remember saying, oh, he's coming to the net more. And I was like, you know, he actually, Tony Roach talked about that a lot with Roger when he coached him. So did I. So, you know, there's a lot of people that have contributed, but what we're seeing now with Roger, Mike, is he's doing it on all surfaces, and he's doing it relentlessly. Even when he's missing a few balls, he's not backing up. Some of that has to do with the larger racket frame he's using. The 97 square inch frame is bigger, so the sweet spot's a little bit bigger, which gives him a little bit more margin for that incredible racket head speed he has. And I think now, I really think a lot of this, look, we all have epiphanies in life, and I think that six-month break last year, while it was really tough for Roger, he also came to grips with his mortality, with the fact that the clock is ticking. And I think that in many ways kind of freed him up now to do what he's gone into this year without a sense of urgency, but with a huge sense of enjoyment. And when you can do that, when you can approach it with that kind of enjoyment, I think it diffuses that huge pressure cooker that they live in. And so now that's why we saw what we saw in Australia. That's why we saw what we saw at Wimbledon with Roger not losing a set. And I think that's why we've seen Rafa play great this year, too. Rafa's taken a lot of time to build up his momentum, but I tell you what, Federer and Nadal are having absolutely spectacular years, and it's just great to see.
Paul Anika, the book is called Coaching for Life. But before we turn the page to Pete Sampras, and I'm not going to put you on the spot. They used to try to ask Fred Astaire about his dancing partners. Okay, so. I'll tell you what, Federer to me is the GOAT, except if I had to pick one of them to play for my life, it would probably be Pete. Okay.
Can I ask you why? Can I be the interviewer?
Okay. Here's why.
Why would you pick? Okay.
All right. It's a long answer, but you know what? It's my podcast. So what the
there
hell?
You go.
Okay.
Exactly.
So, all right. This to me is the LeBron Michael discussion in tennis. Federer is a better all-around tennis player than Pete Sampras is. He has more weapons than Pete did, okay? LeBron, to me, influences a basketball game in more positive ways than anybody who has ever lived. He does more things well than even Magic Johnson because he's got a better body and he's more athletic than Magic Johnson. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And Michael's three or four things that he did exceptionally well, he did better than anybody who ever played, okay? And I believe that if it was my life on the line, despite all the gifts that Roger Federer had, on a surface that was fair to both of them, and I want to ask you afterwards which surface you'd like to see that match on, mm-hmm. I would go with Pete Sampras because I believe in the biggest moments of the match. And I believe he'll be able to do this at the age of 70, Paul. His serve would win the day.
Okay, that's fair. That's I was just curious because there isn't a right or wrong. It's a great conversation, and I've had it 50 times. And I'll give you here's a little anecdote for you that you might like. When Pete beat Andre, I believe in the finals of the 90, it was either 99 or 97. I think it was 97 Wimbledon. Pete beat Andre, and his second serve speed average, I believe, went up between 6 and 7 miles per hour in the finals against Andre when you're going to be most nervous. And I remember going through the stats afterwards. I sat down with Pete and I said, "Do you realize that your second serve speed went up?" And I said, "Tell me what your reasoning is." He said, "Well, it's two things. One, because it's Andre, and I have to." And two, because I can. I was like, okay. You know, and he wasn't being arrogant. He was just saying, that's what I do. And if I lose, I'm losing doing what I do best. And I think my best is better than anybody else's when they compare that having to counterpunch. You know, it's the great analogy, the great pitcher versus the great hitter. Who's going to win that? Most times a great pitcher does. And that was Andre and Pete.
Talking to Paul Anacone, who coached Roger Federer and Pete Sampras in the same career, our late friend Bud Collins once said that the greatest single stroke he ever saw in tennis was Pete's second serve ace in a fifth set tiebreaker against Alex Correggia on a day when Pete had booted in Louis Armstrong Stadium. And, you know, and for all the people who used to say, oh, Pete's not always in the best shape and all that stuff, to me, that day was the greatest example I've ever seen of Pete Sampras's athletic character.
100%. And people, you know, people don't realize when you're an introverted person and you're introspective, that doesn't mean you're not fighting your backside off. And
right.
Pete was the most, I mean, he was the most laser-like focused athlete I've ever been around. He that's why his circle of how we operated was very small. He only did that because he knew exactly what he had to do to maximize his skills, and he wasn't gonna risk it. He knew the window for his athletic career was short. So here's what I need to do. Here's how I'm going to do it. But just because he wasn't, you know, doing cartwheels and tilting umpires' chairs over and smashing rackets, don't misconstrue that. He is one of the greatest gladiators that's played tennis, and he will do absolutely everything to figure out a way to get through a match. And he did it in a very quiet, very ninja-like way. But it was there.
We're talking to Paul Anacone, one of the great tennis coaches of all time. Paul, when you think back on that last Sunday at the Open against Andre, and you know, because of the scheduling of the Open, I will always believe Pete would have won at least two more Opens if he had a day of rest between the semis and the final. It's the way it was at the Open, Super Saturday followed by Sunday. I don't believe that Leighton would have beaten him. I don't believe Safin would have beaten him. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But that again, if we're talking about Pete's athletic character, that fourth set was one of the most compelling things I have ever seen. And I'll tell you why. Because he knew he couldn't win in five. So he knew that that fourth set was a fifth set against Andre Agassi, his greatest rival. And I forget what game it was. You'll remember better than I. There was that long deuce game in the fourth set where Pete could not be beaten. And it won him his 14th major championship.
Yeah, I think it was towards the end. Was it 3-all or 4-all? It was towards the end of the fourth set. And you're right. I just think that he – and look, don't forget, that last 2002 Open, Pete played his last five matches in 7 days because of the rain that year.
Right.
He played five matches, 3 out of 5 sets. And that is a heavy workload for any athlete, and same with Andre. So they were grinding that year, and you're right. I think that's one advantage of having a great weapon like a serve, and it's even a bigger advantage when you back that weapon up with the mind that Sampras had. I just think he had an incredibly laser focused mind in a really quiet way, but there was clarity and there was confidence and there was commitment like you've never seen. And to me, I learned a ton just being around it. And one of the things that I find really interesting, people ask me about this a lot, Mike, is I would actually say Pete is more like Rafa than Roger in terms of his, Pete just doesn't show it. He's not the extroverted Rafa Nadal. He's the same kind of feeling, but it's introverted. And that is almost more intimidating because the people in the locker room, the folks around you, they don't get a bead on what's really going on because you're just kind of quiet. You float around. You're a little bit like an assassin. You get through matches. You do your press conferences and you kind of pick up and go. There was an aura that was very different. And Rafa has a similar aura on the court, except he's much more aggressive about it. There's a lot bigger personality. Someone like Roger, everybody's buddy. I mean, he's always chatting in the locker rooms. He's hanging out. He's just very different. So it's a matter of trying to figure out how to make your own personality hit its maximum potential so that those skills come out. And look, I've been lucky. I've seen a few different guys do it different ways, and I've learned a ton from it. So it's been fun.
We're talking with my pal Paul Anacone about the U.S. Open tennis on the Mike Lubica podcast. Much more with Paul after this from Exxon and Mobil Synergy Gasoline. Engineered to provide better gas mileage, lower emissions, and improve engine responsiveness with 7 key ingredients. Stop by your nearest Exxon or Mobil station today to experience Synergy Gasoline. Paul Anacone is my guest today on the Mike Lubegan podcast. His book is called Coaching for Life. Buy it, because not just for the stories. Paul, what are the lessons that you took from coaching these guys that you talk about in this book for the rest of us?
Well, I think, you know, I guess the probably the biggest lesson really is, you know, the theme of, you know, it's one of my chapter's titles is The Power of Belief. It's a matter of trying to understand what your skill sets are and how to get the most out of them. And you know, that is easy to say, but it's very difficult to do when pressure comes, when adversity comes, when expectations loom. Everyone kind of wilts or falters a little bit. And that's when the greats find ways to dig down. And they deal with that through adversity. They deal with it by having a positive sense of inevitability, like something's, you know, something's going to come. I'm going to figure this out. I'll figure my way through this. And they do that out of practice. It doesn't just all of a sudden happen. So, you know, there's a couple stories in here. One of my, I got to tell you, which is really interesting, and you'll remember it, is that when Pete broke the then record of Roy Emerson's 12 major titles at Wimbledon in 2000, when he beat Pat Rafter in the finals, that was one of the most amazing things I had seen as a coach and as an athlete. In his second round match, he injured his right shin, and there's a sheath that protects the tendon that allows your toe to go up and down so that you can get on the balls of your feet. He had a significant injury, so he couldn't really flex his foot, and he couldn't walk, to the point of every off day, he never hit a ball. He would play a match and literally go home, sit in the house for almost 36 hours, go down to the court, get three or four injections, walk on the court, no warm-up, walk on the court, play, and do the same thing, rinse and repeat five times until you win the title. And for an athlete to be able to get through that, and he literally, Mike, would not move around. He couldn't move around the house. He was hopping around on one leg, and it was the most amazing strength of mind I've ever seen, because I was trying, you know, I was pretty young still, and I was trying to be rah-rah guy, and I think he was probably ready to strangle me by the tournament was over, because I'm trying to convince him that you never know what's going to happen, you just got to go out on the court, and you're Pete Sampras, and your serve is great, and, you know, the doctor said you're not going to do any more damage, and that the shots will allow you to play, and yada, 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 and I was trying to do all the rah-rah stuff. And somehow he was able to win the title, to win his seventh Wimbledon that year in 2000. And it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And there's a big part of the book that's about that, which is dealing with adversity, which is trying to figure out ways to deal with stuff in the most difficult moments. And whether it's Sampras, whether it's his way, whether it's Federer's way, whether it's Nadal, you know, whether it's LeBron James or these all-time greats, they find ways to do things when stuff isn't perfect. And Mike, you know as well as I do, the guy that's screaming at the umpire for an extra 10 minutes on the baseball field, the guy in the basketball court, the tennis player that won't let go of something that happened 15 minutes ago. You know, those things are things that are demise. That's a cop-out, and that's an inability to manage adversity and find ways to not let what just happened affect what's about to happen. And the greats to me are just incredible with how they do it. And it's learned. It didn't just happen. It's learned. And Roger, I talk about it with Roger in the book too, where, you know, he got over a very difficult time in his life where he was temperamental as a kid. He was really, he struggled when he was young. And I asked him, I said, who convinced you? He said, you know, ultimately it had to be me. I had to take responsibility. I had to have accountability. And I knew that it wasn't allowing me to do my best in the biggest moments. And so, you know, when you look at kids and you look at players like Nick Kyrgios and people say, who should coach him? I always say, well, whoever he'll listen to. You know, he's got to buy into it. There's no, John McEnroe's not going to walk up to Nick Kyrgios and wave a magic wand and Nick's going to be perfect. You know, Phil Jackson's not going to go up to Nick Kyrgios and Nick's all of a sudden going to listen to every word. So the player has to drive a lot of it, and the greats tend to drive the most incredible habits that allow them to succeed in moments where you and I would kind of go, check, please. and not be there. And that, to me, was such a huge learning curve as a coach. And then I basically, as I continued coaching, tried to ingrain those habits and tried to teach them to younger players so that as they get older, it becomes the norm. It becomes what's expected, and it doesn't seem supernatural or superhuman.
Paul Anika once beat John McEnroe in the first round of the U.S. Open. It was 31 years ago. McEnroe had taken a sabbatical. I had gone out to some celebrity thing in Reno, and I had heard about the joys of yoga and how he was committed to the second half of his career. And everything was good. This was going to be the jump start of the second half of his career, okay? And the score in the first round of the Open was 1-6, 6-1, 6-3, 6-3 to Anacone. What the hell happened that day?
I know, it's amazing. You know, they say in life everybody gets their 15 minutes, and you know, it was kind of bitter. Look, you have to be proud as an athlete when you do terrific things. But I grew up, you know, John's only a few years older than me, so I was always a big fan of his talents. And it was great to win that match. And I grew up in New York, too, so it was pretty spectacular for me. John beat me pretty badly the week before in a tournament on Long Island, the Hamlet Cup. But he was coming back, you know, he was trying to get back into the rhythm of being the great John McEnroe. And he definitely wasn't. And he was a little bit vulnerable. And you mentioned all the things that he was trying to get into. He was at a time of his career where he was trying to rejuvenate himself, and he was still vulnerable. And fortunately for me, I was the guy on the other side of the net that happened to get that opportunity. And for me, I played well. I played well that day. So I enjoyed it. But then guess what? I lost 7-6 in the fifth in the next round to Aaron Krikstein. So it was very short-lived. But I'll tell you what, Mike, after the match with Aaron Krikstein, My pint of chocolate Häagen-Dazs was so good. It tasted so good that I ate the whole thing. That was the way I kind of drowned my sorrows after that loss.
Paul Anacone, I'm going to talk to him for a few more minutes because he's got to go pick up his wife at the airport. Okay. Pete versus Andre for the championship of all time. First of all, what surface do we want to see that? Excuse me, not Pete versus Andre. Pete versus Fed. What surface do we want to see that match on?
Wow. I mean, can I sidetrack for 1 second? Here's the thing. In today's game, the issue is the surfaces are much more homogenized. And I actually think, and this is a conversation for another time, but I actually think that because the surfaces are more homogenized now, the players that are great, the big four that are great, it's actually easier for them to dominate because the surfaces are more similar. So there aren't as many, let's say, Michael Stieks or Richard Krajicek's or Goran Ivanišević's that are going to get you on the fast courts because there aren't that many fast courts. I mean, look, every time Isner's in the draw or Ivo Karlovic, there's a little less vulnerability because of the conditions today. So that being said, I think Roger, you know, the best tennis would probably be on a hard court, you know, kind of a fast hard court at the U.S. Open. The Wimbledon grass is way different. I remember, oh, you would have loved this, Mike. You would have loved being a fly on the wall. When I first started coaching Roger, the first year he came out to Indian Wells, he came through L.A., and I got to go to dinner with Roger and Pete. And Pete was, it was just so great to hear Pete go, when we played, you were serving and volleying on everything on the grass, you were coming in. What the hell, what's going on now? Everyone's staying back at Wimbledon. What's happening? How's this happening? And it was very interesting to say, because Roger said, well, look, to be honest with you, people aren't really coming in anymore, and everybody plays the same way, and I'm kind of playing better than them at it right now. So that I don't, you know, and it was really very, it was very pragmatic. It was really simple. And so Pete said, so what would happen if you played a serve and volleyer? He said, well, I would start serving and volleying again. So it's really interesting, the dynamics of how it changes. So I would imagine a medium fast hard court with these guys, with Roger's racket skills, the ability to take the ball early, the ability to return serve and defend, his first serve and first strike mentality would be awesome. And then we would get to see the great Sampras's second serve. the best second serve in the history again. What can he do against a guy like Roger Federer with second serves on a fast hard court over 3 out of 5 sets? I mean, it would be fun, and it's all that stuff is so subjective, but it's a great conversation to have, and it gives us guys a lot to talk about.
You know, we're talking to Paul Anacone on the Mike Lupica podcast. Go buy his book, Coaching for Life. You will love it. It'll be like eating ice cream. Okay. Even when they played that EXO tour, I forget how many years ago, okay? And Roger's still in his prime, and Pete is obviously in retirement. I watched a couple of those matches, Paul, and all I was thinking was, what's going on out there even now is something that the only two people who understand are the people on the other side of the net from each other.
100% right. And I got to say, even Pete said to me, he goes, I can't believe Roger wanted to do this. You know, I wouldn't want to do this in the middle. And I asked Roger about it. He goes, oh, this is great. You know, to go out with Pistol and do this in Asia, and then we got to play at Madison. This was so much fun. To him, it wasn't about winning or losing. It was about bringing tennis to these places, spending some time with someone who he'd really looked up to, Sampras, and traveling around and having fun competing. And he's so secure. He didn't, you know, if Pete got hot and won a set or won the match somewhere in Madison Square Garden, did he win a set or did Pete, I don't know. Anyway, Roger didn't care. He was just like, this is just great. It's great for me. It's great for tennis. It's fun for Pete. Let's do it. You know, and that's what I mean about Roger's disposition. It is so interesting and so amazing that he can see outside his own bubble and look at the expansiveness of whatever he's doing. And that's what makes him truly unique. So you're exactly right. During that time, those two guys were the only ones that really knew what that meant.
All right, a couple more questions for Paul Anacone, then I have to let him go. Now, people can watch you on the Tennis Channel, 8 to 11 every morning Eastern during the U.S. Open, is that right?
Yep, we have that morning show, 8 to 11 every morning on Tennis Channel, the pregame with Mary and Brett Haber and Jim Courier and Lindsay Davenport. We got the whole gang up there, James Blake. It's a lot of fun.
They have, I'm telling you, I've written about this. They have a stupid amount of fun on the Tennis Channel. Okay. If there is going to be what my sons call a rando to win the U.S. Open on the men's side this year, it would be whom?
Sasha Zverev. He's the closest one knocking at the door, won 2 Masters 1000s this year, beat Rogers, beaten Novak. He's at the doorstep right now. If I was picking someone, it would be him, and he's on the correct side of the draw to do it. He's not on Rafa and Roger's side, and look out for that young man. He's something special.
You were so great to do this today. There was nobody else I wanted to talk to about this Open, especially after watching Federer and Tiafoe last night. Again, Tennis Channel every morning, 8 to 11 Eastern Time. Mary and Paul and Blake and Courier and all those guys. The book is called Coaching for Life. I strongly urge you to buy it. This is one of my I've been around tennis way too long, and Paul Anacone is not only one of my favorite people, he's one of the gents I've ever met in this sport. Thank you so much for doing this today.
Mike, you're a great guy. Anytime, and I really appreciate the plug. The book is on Amazon.com. It's on my website, paulanacone.com. It was a lot of fun. I hope the people read it and get something out of it. It was really enjoyable. And I will see you, my friend, at the tennis.
All right. Paul Anacone, Coaching for Life. Thanks, pal.
Thanks so much. You take care.
If you love tennis, and I love tennis, and the first real money I ever made in sports writing was as a tennis writer, this was a conversation to get you teed up for the U.S. Open. And again, think about it. Belichick only got to coach Brady. Paul Anacone got to coach Federer and Sampras in the same lifetime. It's merely 33 major championships between them. I'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.